Good evening, everybody. Welcome to IDEAS, which is the Centre for Diplomacy and Strategy here at the LSE. Once upon a time, we were known as the Cold War Studies Centre, but we are now IDEAS. And I'll let you draw the conclusion about the connection between the two. I think there is one. I think everybody would concur, at least with one thing, that 1989 was, without any question, one of the great momentous years of the 20th century. And many of us would argue that it is still helping shape and define the nature of what we call the 21st century. The question is, though, how do we remember 1989? In my view, there's always been two weaknesses in the way that maybe people in this country or Europe or the United States remember it. And the two weaknesses are Eurocentrism and Americocentrism. In other words, we remember 1989 as either the liberation of Europe, what actually happened in Poland, finally the coming down of the Berlin Wall. Or, if you're an American, pretend what kind of American you are, you define this as the moment when America won the Cold War. But as anybody's looked at 1989 and all of its ramifications, you know this is a very simplified, limited story. Because there's another tale, another set of stories to be told, and one of those, of course, is about what we're going to be talking about here this evening. Not what happened in Poland, or coming down of the Berlin Wall, Gorbachev, Helmut Kohl, and all the rest, but what actually happened in the most populous country in the world, namely the People's Republic of China in 1989. So we thought it absolutely essential as a serious centre to think through some of the consequences of what actually happened in China in 1989, and of course to think about in particular what happened at Tiananmen Square on 4th of June 1989. And I'm very, very pleased to bring together three wonderful speakers, three great experts on China, and indeed with some experience, direct and personal, of what happened on that tragic day in June of 1989. To my immediate right is Professor Atta Hussain of the Asia Research Center, who knows China, lives in China, works in China, speaks Chinese, knows a lot about China. And Professor Hussain will give some background on the origins of Tiananmen, thinking about the movement, causes of that movement, what was happening in the party leadership, what was happening amongst the student movement. Following that, delighted for the first time to chair my very dear old friend. I should even call you comrade on an evening like this, I suppose, Professor Chen Zhen. By the way, he wants me always to be referred to as the chairman during this meeting, and I think those who know China know who we're referring to. But it's been wonderful having Professor Chen Zhen here for the year as the Philip Remond Chair from Cornell University, one of the great historians of the Chinese Revolution. We've been making him work very hard here this year. He said he's delighted to go back to the United States to have a rest. But we'll be very, very sad to see you go. But before Professor Chen Zhen is leaving or will leave, I wanted to use his expertise, his knowledge and his personal background and understanding to think about 1989 in the wider context. Because we don't want to be too Eurocentric about what happened or Americocentric about what happened in 1989. We don't want to be too Sinocentric. In other words, what happened in 1989 was part of a broader crisis of an international system and ideology which we broadly call official communism. So what Professor Chen Zhen will do is provide the international framing of that. And thirdly and finally, a colleague from the Department of Economic History here, Dr. Debin Ma, who will provide some personal perspective on 1989. Dr. Ma was from Shanghai. He was in Shanghai at the time. He has some memories of that period, and he's going to therefore reflect on that and what it meant to him, and indeed what he thinks it means more generally for us here today. So with no further ado, welcome again, and I'll hand the floor over to Professor Hussain, who will speak for 15 to 20 minutes. Like the chairman, I will impose very strong discipline, not of the Cultural Revolutionary type, but I will impose some strong discipline, and then we'll move on to Chen Zhen, and then finally to Dr. Mark. Over to you, Asa.
So, Thank you very much. And what I want to do is something fairly straightforward, is to say what the events were in April, May and June 1989. Obviously 1989 is a very fateful, important year, because that June the 4th, 1989 was the first, it seems like in retrospect, first installment of things to come, like the fall of the Berlin Wall and eventual fall of communism in Eastern Europe. Second thing, obviously, June the 4th is important because that's the event when the People's Liberation Army actually entered Tiananmen Square and emptied it of students, whoever students were remaining, by force. What I want to do is to just go through it before we analyze the events, what the sequence of events were. The movement started with the death of Huya Bang, the ex-general secretary of the Communist Party, on April the 15th. On April the 18th, 3 days later, the students entered Tiananmen Square carrying placards. Before then, there were various slogans and writings on the martyrs' memorial in the middle of Tiananmen Square. And then the square was occupied by students. And then from the first week of May, we see that thing actually starts to take on the character of a mass movement joined by people other than students. And by the third week or 18th of May, it actually becomes a mass movement. For about 2 weeks in May, the top leadership in China was completely split down the middle. And it seems be right to say that China did not have a proper leadership for about 2 to 3 weeks. And then martial law was declared in the third week of May, and finally the army entered and cleared the streets and the area around the center of Beijing of students and other people. There are various strands to the movement. So one is really the student demonstration. So here it's important to keep in view that there had been a number of student protest movements after the Cultural Revolution. There was obviously the famous Democracy Wall in 78-79, when people call, apart from the Ford modernization, also called for fifth modernization, which is democracy and political reform. Then there was, in 1986, demonstration which finally led to the removal of Huya Bang as the general secretary of the party. So throughout these events, what we see is what I would call a very particular style of removal or change of leadership. That is, with particular events, or almost like internal coup, the general secretaries of the party and the top positions actually change. China has actually been quite different after 1989. So the third event is really the economic climate. Economic reforms were extremely successful to begin with. They brought prosperity to a vast number of people, but from 87 onwards, we start to see some losers. There was a massive acceleration of inflation. Many of the salaries hadn't adjusted to the new price level, and there was general worry about a section of the population start to feel the pinch or not being able to maintain the living standards. So I think that there are different strands to the movement. Because of various conjunction of events, they came together. So the internal dynamics of the movement is very much due to the division of the leadership and the absence of leadership at the top. That's when I would argue that the movement assumed a mass character and it started to look like joined by ordinary people. Whether was it similar, in what ways was it similar to what happened on the other side of the Great Wall in 1989. There is one very important difference, that is, in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, there was a general sense of economic failure. There was a general recognition that these economies have not done as well as their capitalist counterparts. And this was an old feeling. there's no feeling of general failure in China. Obviously, because the acceleration of inflation, they were losers. But on the other hand, the general feeling was China has done extremely well, agriculture reforms have succeeded and lifted vast number of people out of poverty, and also the living standards improved in urban areas. So in China, if there were economic problems, they arose out of success rather than of a failure. That's a very important difference. And LSE was there at the start of the movement, because that actually happened to coincide with the first LSE and Chinese Academy of Social Sciences conference. And in fact, the LSE delegates then, led by the then director of the school, we are staying in the Minzu Hotel, which is just on the western side of Tiananmen Square. We were actually there when the students started to enter the square. We did not stay until the 4th of June, but actually did experience the occupation of the square by students, because when we had actually meetings with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Was it a movement directed against Communist Party? On the other hand, it doesn't seem so, because as I remember reading whatever I could read, and this and Martyrs Memorial, and also the placards, it was rather than the direct criticism of the Communist Party, they actually appealed to the Communist Party. And a lot of slogans were anti-corruption. So in some sense they were appealing. Many of the gestures used by students actually were repetition of traditional Chinese practices or rituals or appealing to the emperor. The famous scene when the leadership was meeting in the Great Hall of the People, the three students knelt on the steps of the Great Hall of the People, wanting to appeal and see the top leadership. This is, I understand, a very traditional way of appealing to the emperor. So in some sense, the rituals, although it might seem there was the goddess of democracy and so on, came in. So there were non-Chinese elements, but there are a lot of elements which are very similar to Chinese elements and appealing to the Communist Party. Here I'd like to emphasize one thing, is that the way we remember events is not exactly a repetition of reality. These events, in retrospect, acquire a significance of their own and become iconic symbols of particular events. So, for example, if you look at May the 4th, 1919, it's become a symbol, in one hand, signifying China's semi-colonial status and really Chinese people rising against colonialism. So it has become a symbol. So the same way I feel that June the 4th, 1989 would become a symbol of democracy. So whenever that comes to China, June the 4th, 1989 will be remembered as really when there was a general demand for democracy. But the developments since 1989 are worth reflecting on. The change in leadership has become far more organized, even though the present general secretary of the party was still nominated by Deng Xiaoping. So China has had since two changes of leadership, and sort of in a fairly orderly manner, although selected by a small group. China also managed to avoid, at least, and that's the great merit of Deng Xiaoping, any large-scale purges. In fact, very few people were actually purged, and the present prime minister actually was accompanied Jia Ziyang to Tiananmen Square and was reinstated. So in some sense, that was a great merit of Deng Xiaoping, that he actually managed, he wanted to avoid another rerun of the Cultural Revolution. It could have happened. Other thing, it was not any opposition between supporters of reform and opponents of reform. In fact, there was no opposition to the reforms as such. Much more appeal was to avoid corruption and accountability of the party, rather than I didn't see any slogans for or against reform. So in fact, reforms continued, resumed after a year, and actually continued at a very fast pace since. So in some sense, the question I'd like to ask, well, let me first sort of put forward some proposition, and Chen Jian would actually take up. The first argument is that the life expectancy of the one-party state, the Communist Party, is not indefinite. The world we live in, and is nothing to do with China, the only long-term source of legitimacy is actually democracy, whether we like it or not. And that is of particular importance for communist parties or communist states, because they have destroyed traditional sources of authority. So in some sense, ultimately, their authority depends on either having a siege mentality, that is, threat to China from other countries, which it no longer has. So in some sense, the question still haunts the Communist Party, is what right it has to be the sole government of China and have the monopoly of power. So sooner or later, I don't know which form, democracy will come to China, not because people would convert. The second thing I'd like to emphasize, the democracy is born not because people one day convert to ideas of democracy, right, convert to religion. It arises out of often very non-democratic circumstances because of political necessity. So democracy actually fulfills an important function, and it develops and grows not because people get converted to democratic ideals, but because political situation makes it as a necessity. So let me stop with this cryptic remark and turn to Professor Chen Jian.
Chen Jian.
Thank you, Professor Cox. Chairman Cox.
Chairman Cox, please, yes.
Comrade Cox.
There we go.
And also Professor Hossein. And you have set up a very good background for me to share with this audience of some of my own ideas, observations of the 20th anniversary of 1989. I cannot believe it is already 20 years. Memory and reflections are still so vivid. But yes, already it has been 20 years. 1989 was a year of extraordinary importance in many different senses. It was the year that history witnessed the failure of international communism as an alternative of the preferred path compared with liberal capitalism toward modernity. It witnessed the beginning of the end of the Soviet Empire, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc, as symbolized in the fall of the Berlin Wall. And also, it recorded the end of the global Cold War, an event at one point. Some of my political science friends have argued that it would continue forever. And as I will argue, not from a Eurocentric perspective, certainly not an American-centric perspective. I will rather argue from a Sino-centric perspective. That is because of several reasons. One is because in the chain of events of 1989, the event in June, early June, was really important. In a sense, it shaped in many different ways the sequence of development and orientation of development of 1989. And secondly, the Chinese communist state, in a sense, created the momentum of 1989 toward the particular direction of what I have described, three consequences of that year. But in the same time, he survived 1989. And why did that happen? And also, more importantly, what happened in China reflected some of the larger issues facing 20th century world history. The challenges facing international communism and also the challenges facing the Chinese communist state are interrelated. And in some senses, in living in the 21st century, we are still feeling the profound legacy and impact of 1989. We cannot escape it. International communism was not a joke. It was real. It was not just something that Karl Marx wrote in his studies. It was turned into a huge movement, sweeping across the entire world, causing profound military and political confrontation in the second half of the 20th century. At one point, it had made people throughout the world who against communists really scared. That was because those for communism and those against communism somehow all believed that communism was a force representing the future. And this was because communism was indeed beautiful at one level as a political philosophy if it was not put into action. However, communism was something that was put into action, and this was particularly true in the Soviet Union and certainly was true in China. However, that was really the beginning of the origin of 1989. The legitimacy challenges facing the international communist movement and also facing the Chinese communist state. And my wife is now sitting there and is taking photo for me. And she has heard many times of a statement I made about Mao's statement at the formation of the People's Republic of China. We, the Chinese people, have stood up. I will repeat that quote again because this is really a legitimacy statement. And throughout the 27 years of Mao's reign of China, and the Chinese chairman, that's a Chinese chairman, who had tried very hard to turn China into a land of universal justice and equality, while at the same time, by presenting the Chinese case as an example, to revive China's central position in the world. Therefore, in his description, there was communist discourse, there was also revolutionary nationalism. And Mao's revolution failed badly. Some of the episodes of Mao's revolution indeed were the worst in 20th century human experience, such as Great Leap Forward and Great Proletarian Revolution. Therefore, Mao's revolutions were facing increasingly more profound legitimacy challenges. However, I will argue, Mao's revolutions were not without legitimacy. That was built in Mao's legitimate statement, which the Chinese people have stood up. Following Mao's death, China entered an age of reform and opening to the outside world. At that period, beginning in the late 1970s, was characterized by paradoxes. By releasing the production power that had been suppressed by Mao's revolutionary programs, by taking over the kind of philosophy that was characterized in Deng Xiaoping's famous cat theory, black cat, white cat, as long as it's cat that catches mouse. It's a good cat. But most important of all, by mobilizing something that had been suppressed in the past because of various reasons, wars, crisis, revolutions. And now, under the age of reform, in the age of reform and opening, everything was concentrated in China for the increase of productivity. After all, this is China. This is a country with the most continuous history and the largest population in the world. It has a profound cultural and other resources. The reform and opening age had registered already before Tiananmen impressive economic growth. However, at the same time, there was still the legitimacy challenge. Reform has created all kinds of changes, not just in the economic field, but also in terms of society, in terms of culture. And most important of all, it challenged in the very fundamental sense of the Chinese Communist Party's one-party dictatorship. Increasingly, people are asking one question. The reform and opening had buried the Maoist illusion of general egalitarianism. And it has created, among other things, what was supposed to be buried by the Chinese Communist Revolution, namely division between the rich and the poor, and also all kinds of pre-revolution phenomena have been brought back into the post-1978 period. And then, how can the party that ruled China still call itself the Chinese Communist Party? Where is communism? And furthermore, with the collapse of people's inner support to communism and the guiding official ideology to lead China toward modernity, there was a kind of nihilism. The people's profound sense of crisis in face. If communism is not the guide principle, what is it? Give me some kind of ism that will direct China toward the future. No one can answer that question. And the reform and opening area, especially in the 1980s, I witnessed all kinds of no's. No bourgeoisie liberalization in particular. However, what should be the yes? It's an unanswered question. Therefore, a profound paradox has created a gap between the rapidly changing society, economy, and culture, and the political institution. I completely agree with Professor Hossein. You know, the Chinese crisis in the 1980s was not really the failure of economy. But I would like to add one thing. That no matter to what extent the Chinese economy has improved in the 1980s, however, it was never able to reach people's expectations. It was what people perceive, and the lack of capacity on the part of the Chinese Communist regime to answer some very profound questions in people's perception that created the conditions leading to 1989. And Professor Hossein has described what happened in 1989. And what I would like to highlight were two questions. One, why did the Chinese Communist Party leadership decide to use force to solve this problem, the challenge? Were there alternatives? This is a very big question. And Zhao Ziyang, the Chinese Communist Party General Secretary, who was ousted during the crisis, recently published his memoir. And he argued, yes, the alternatives certainly were there. And there was no need to use the military means to solve the question. You know, I will argue, given how the legitimacy crisis or challenge and crisis have been shaped, and given how the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist state have been defined, and especially given those who represented the Chinese Communist state, who are in power, who they are, probably there was no alternative. You know, you read the documentation, you go through it, you find the logic of it is very clear. You know, this is a party which was based upon Mao's famous saying, the chairman's very famous saying, that political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. It remains effective in 1989. And secondly, why did the Chinese communist regime survive? Why did other communist countries collapse? Many reasons, but I would like to argue for a few things. First of all, I will argue that Chinese communist state and the Communist Party contributed to the collapse of the international communist movement. And that happened long before 1989. By the late 1970s, when China was embarking on the process of reform and opening, it already withdrew from the global Cold War. The Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc was identified as China's most dangerous enemy. And China made it a reality that more communists, or people who live under communism, were favoring capitalism than favoring communism, long before the end of the Cold War. The Cold War was fundamentally a contest about which way of life, communism or liberal capitalism, was more superior. And somehow the Chinese-American rapprochement and also China's adoption of liberal capitalism market economy had fundamentally obscured the boundary between the two, making it impossible for any communist to still convincingly argue that communism is indeed a force representing the future. And also in 1989, by using force to solve the crisis, and when the Chinese People's Government sent the People's Liberation Army into the People's Square to open fire on the people, it has created an image internationally that was so unfavorable to communism, which was supposed to be a political philosophy representing the fundamental interests of the people, when the global media repeatedly on live television carried one scene, a young man alone standing in front of the PLA's moving tanks. I will say the moral foundation of international communism collapsed. If not for anything else, it made what happened in Beijing in June made it less possible for any other communist government, either in the Soviet Union or in East Europe, to be successfully follow the same example of the Chinese Communist state, not to mention that they did not have the kind of fundamental condition as the Chinese Communist state to do the same thing. But why the Chinese Communist regime survived 1989, or even go beyond? Very fundamentally, I will say the 1989 event did not completely destroy the legitimacy foundation of the People's Republic of China. And Deng Xiaoping and the Chinese Communist leadership were successful in transforming the legitimacy narrative of the Chinese Communist state, not only to survive, make it survive 1989, but go beyond it. Basically, through several things. One was that increasingly you will find in defining the Chinese Communist state, already beginning in the years of reform and opening, but especially during and after 1989. So emphasis, the legitimacy emphasis, was increasingly shifting from the second adjective, namely communist, to Chinese. And also in the Chinese Communist Party's handling a post-1989 situation, not only the purge was in Chinese standard, was not a severe. But more importantly, you find that they were so successful in linking the forces challenging the government to the ones that were associated with the West. For example, Fang Liji, the famous scientist who took refuge in American embassy. And how could he enter American embassy in the first place? And that made a symbol of the movement so closely associated with the force of international imperialism. And also there's a very famous cultural critique of a TV series called Heshang River Eulogy. And it was the basic theme of the TV series was that China's problems were really related to some of the fundamental flaws of Chinese culture. And in order to transform China, you must go toward the ocean, embrace the larger blue sky and ocean. And this was interpreted as a fundamental negation by those who favor wholesale reform, including political reform, in 1989, as though as if they were the force that negated Chinese culture, the force that embraced the Western culture. While in the case of the Soviet Union and East Europe, nationalism played the role as an agent of undermining the legitimacy of a particular form of state. In the case of China, the transformation of revolutionary nationalism into a ideological defense of the Chinese state, although it was in name still ruled by a Chinese Communist Party, that played a role to change the fate of state. But more importantly, I will argue, this is also following Professor Hossein's argument earlier, and it's also my conclusion, the continuation of the reform opening project. After all, no matter to what extent the reform opening had divided the Chinese population, had made the Chinese society very different compared with Maoist egalitarian society, no matter to what extent it made some people gain, some people lose, it has two fundamental benefits. One was that it made the Chinese society more poor. This is some force that we must remember in trying to understand the China's long-range development. And also secondly, it somehow at one level fit China's past, present, and future back to Mao's grand statement, the chairman's grand statement, that we, the Chinese people, have stood up. As long as that a legitimate state statement is still valid, the Chinese Communist state or so-called Chinese Communist state or whatever Chinese state will survive. Will it strive? Will it sustain China's continuous rise in the 21st century? That is a foundational issue. That is a constitutional issue. It's a historic, I suspect. No greater power can be built upon the support of a constitutional foundation that is flawed by its own inability to provide a comprehensive and complete narrative of its legitimacy. In this sense, we must remember 1989, because otherwise we would not be able to understand the China that we are facing today and that we will be facing in the future.
Thank you very much, Chen Jun. Wonderful. And over finally to Dr. Darren Ma for some reflections on the period, on the day.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. One of the things I want to start out with, I'm an economist, an economic historian. My study of economic history is on China, but it ends before 1949. So I'm really no expert on this, but I think because I'm an economist and an economic historian, I probably am somewhat more practical and maybe also more patient. I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about Eurocentric, American-centric, even China-centric. It's actually a really personal reflection. Mm. It was very, it may be true with some of you here as well, 1989 was very special to me personally as well, because I left China in 1989 in September. Now, first of all, I want to start with I have no personal involvement in the movement itself. I don't claim any credit for that. I was unemployed. I was one of those, you know, China, Wei Youming, so I'm not good enough to be the part of the big event. But I think it was very interesting, and it reminds me that, well, actually, it reminds me one thing. I'm 20 years older than when I was in 1989. So I want to sort of echo some of the bigger scenes, but giving a bit of a more of a personal reflection and thinking about what I think is something that's very interesting. It's very different to thinking back now and compare with the time you were thinking at the time. So I lived through China in the 1970s and the 1980s, and all the way up until 1989. Again, there's someone living inside China. There is not really the sense that know, economic growth is good, but there's not a sense of success as we have seen today. All the talk was actually it was going to bound to fail. In fact, there was a publication that came out in 1989 by the American Economist saying that Chinese economic reform has achieved all this and that, but it was really not going anywhere. Economic reform without political reform is not really going to go anywhere. And it's, of course, when Tiananmen happened, and I remember when I left China, the whole entire media is reverting back to the Cultural Revolution style. You know, everything is about how do we, you know, clean up all these anti-revolutionaries, the Fang. I mean, it was really extremely noisy, and it's almost like the 10 years reform is just going nowhere. So it was extremely happy for me, for a lot of people looking at me, that you have left. And I think there was a saying going around, which I've said in other occasions, that there is really a tremendous sense of pessimism at the time. When we were young, we were taught this whole phrase, only communism can save China, because a lot of you Chinese have probably been taught that phrase, because the whole idea, people have tried the various ways of saving China, building a modern China, modern education, legal reform. In the end, they found the communism. Of course, that was obviously propaganda. Now, at the time when the Tiananmen Square tragedy just happened, the same was going around now, because everyone else, every other communist state fell. Only China can save international communism, because no other states
have been.
what if Vietnam, Cuba, North Korea, and so on. But, it was a very sad state. It was the idea, you know, someone like the Jiang Zemin was probably another puppet. He's, you know, his power is not going to, there's really the sense that power was not going to last long. This is very sad for him personally, who likes glamour, and he was very internationally isolated. And I remember, after I went to the States, I went to a talk by a Russian politician talking about the Russian political economic reform. This is still under the Gorbachev. There's tremendous optimism about what's happening in Russia, Eastern Europe. And, you know, I was sitting there in great admiration and so on. After I went and talked to him afterwards, I said, you know, I came from China. And he said immediately, oh, don't worry, just wait. You know, democracy will come to China. Someday China will catch up to Russia, which really warmed my heart at the time. But now, looking at today, it was very odd. But then, of course, the economy collapsed. And this is very interesting. I think all the rhetoric really turned back. This is when people began to realize the economic reform under Mao, under Deng Xiaoping, and also afterward, was really quite an enormous success in many ways. And with the collapse of the Soviet economy, I think the rhetoric have really turned around. I thought that was something that probably really should not be forgotten. And I think I will leave to the major experts to reflect on the big issues. But let me give a couple of my personal observations, how maybe we should, in some sense, remember the Zhong force. Now, again, I'm 20 years older than when I was in 1989. And looking back, a lot of the interesting things really came out. I mean, a lot of people could say the students were probably very naive. If there is a regime change, what will happen in China? We don't know. Probably economic reform, I mean, it's going to be big, big uncertainty. One thing we probably realized, I agree with our target, that democracy is the ultimate way to go. But one thing we do realize, democracy in East Asia or in Asia in general is a very long and complicated process. It is not something that, you know, a demonstration organized within a couple of months and without a very clear agenda. I'm not saying this is the fault of the demonstrators. They simply were not given the time to organize. But this is something that needs to be sought through very carefully, that needs a lot of political experimentation. I think what was happening in Taiwan was, you know, all facets of political democratic experimentation was a very, very important lesson to some degree. And it's very important that kind of lesson need to be learned and what's happening in Korea, and also, for example, what's happening recently in Thailand. Now, what I think really, China as a nation itself, one of the things I find that sometimes worry me when I talk to, one of the things, I think the government of China, obviously, since Jiang Zemin, did not want to talk about Liu Si, and that was very different. Unlike Mao, who think cultural revolution is the great achievements. And nobody, very few people, and very few leaders think about cracking down on students, you know, shooting these people is a great political achievement. The way they wanted to just avoid talking about it. So there's a process of slowly erasing the memory. And you know, that was a process, I think, when I talked to some of the younger students who were, I don't know, born in the 1980s, who had a very little, because within China, there's still that closure information. I think there's a really need for China to openly think about, one way or another, maybe not now, but in the future. I think that's why the publication of Zhao Ziyang's memoir is very important, to really think what we are learning out of it. And that is something I'm slightly worrying that we are not learning. And I think this is something that should be discussed. One thing I experienced when I was in China, you know, thinking back, whatever naivety, innocence the students may have, when I was in Shanghai, what happened, these shootings happened in Beijing, in Tiananmen Square. And Shanghai was, the people were very angry. Okay. They took all kinds of buses, cars, and blocked everything. The entire thing was a standstill, was deadlocked. People couldn't go to work anymore. People couldn't buy daily groceries. One of the things that really struck me, and this is, of course, having the experience in Liuzhou was something I would never have imagined, having been living in China, because I lived through all these years of propaganda. This is the first time there's open, all kinds of views that were openly expressed. Okay, but one thing I think that really struck me is, you know, for somebody who knows people from Shanghai, they are those whiny, you know, extremely complaining type of selfish people. Every little thing, they got into a little argument, they constantly bicker about. But the thing that was very striking that they talked about, at a time when all the traffic was down, nobody complained, because they didn't want the government to use it as any excuse to have a crackdown. So people at that time felt there's a great sense of this great injustice done, that they are willing to pursue the sacrifice for, you know, not, mothers not being able to get milk for the children and so on. In fact, on some of the places where people start complaining, everybody else was saying, no, you shouldn't be complaining. This is the time that we need to be unified. So the point I was trying to say, there is a kind of a learning process, a national sense, which we cannot recover by simply going to a free market economy. And that is something that was a little bit lost in this whole, you know, everything is going for money now. And at some point, if China needs to move forward, that we really need to sit down and look at what was, you know, in a very realistic way, what happened and what does it mean. And I think one of the things is echoing what Professor Chen was talking about earlier. One thing that China succeeded afterwards began to build ideology around nationalism. And eventually, it's going to run up steam. We have to, I think there's a lot of talk now within China about the idea that there is something of a universal value. And we need to really examine all of that. I think the UOC experience is very important.
Thank you very much indeed. In particular, I'd like, with me, to say thank you to our three speakers here tonight. Professor Chen Zhen, Professor Atta Hussein, whose good old leftism is still lurking there somewhere deep in his bones, and for our good friend from the economic historian. Thank you very much.